We're going to start this morning in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 9. Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 9. Where Solomon says, in addition to being a wise man, the preacher, who in Ecclesiastes refers to the main character in the book, whether the writer or the one it's written about is uncertain. And it doesn't necessarily mean preaching in the sense that we think of it, but one who addresses a crowd or an assembly. At any rate, Solomon is the preacher in verse 9. In addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge. And he pondered, searched out, and arranged many proverbs. The preacher sought to find delightful words and to write words of truth correctly. So Solomon says that one of his main missions in life was to gather as much knowledge together as he could. Some of it he came up with himself, he wrote it. Some of it he found, but he was constantly searching around him and throughout the world for knowledge and for wisdom. It was his thing to try to collect as much of that as he could. And he says in verse 11 that the words of wise men are like goads, and the masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. And so he says, when you find something that's truly wise, so Solomon had found all of this knowledge and all of this wisdom. He had searched through all of this learning. And you can imagine that in seeking through all of that writing and all of those books and hearing all of those teachers, there was some of it better than others. And Solomon says in verse 11 that when you find true words of wisdom, it's like a goad, it's like a sharp stick that gets you, it gets your attention, it might hurt a little, but it helps you to move in the right direction. And masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. It's just the right thing in the right place at the right time. Because when it's true wisdom, he says, it comes from God. They're given by one shepherd. But, he says, beyond this, my son, be warned. He says there's knowledge out there that is valuable. You want to attain it if you can. But, he says, be careful, because the writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body. So now you young people still in school, don't get any ideas. Don't even think about going home and the next time your parents or somebody gets on you about doing your homework, don't pull this verse out and say, well, listen, too much of that make you tired. I'm not going to do it. Don't do that. That's not his point. But his point is that there's just so much knowledge in the world, so many things that you can read. Now, this is Solomon writing in about 1,000. This is about 3,000 years ago. And Solomon says the number of books is endless. 3,000 years ago. I can only imagine what Solomon would think today when there are in the world 130 million unique books. That means not copies, but a book. 130 million and 6,000 books being added every day. Self-publishing makes that possible, if not always desirable. But anybody can publish a book now, and lots of people do, and only a few should. But there are millions of books in the world. There are 500 hours of video uploaded to YouTube every day. That's a lot of cat videos. 500 hours every day. 2 billion websites in the world, with 400 added every minute of every day. 300,000 news stories are published in some form every single day. And since the early 2000s, our knowledge of the world has doubled about every year. Almost every year, we know twice as much about the world as we knew before. And I can only imagine that Solomon, if he were living today, what he would say about that. Because in his day, he said, there is so much knowledge out there, it'll drive you crazy. What Solomon would do with TikTok and Snapface and InstaChat and all that stuff, I can't begin to imagine. But Solomon says, if you just to go through all that stuff, it's endless. Now, what he had particularly in mind, you could probably tell from what he's saying, what he had specifically in mind was what we might call personal growth, what we might call wisdom for daily living and how to have the best possible life. Well, if we only confine ourselves to that, the amount of material that you can find, if you say, I want personal growth, I want to get better as a person, the amount of material and knowledge and sources that are available for that is just about endless. You couldn't exhaust it. In 100 lifetimes, you couldn't get through it all. And so Solomon is going to help us out. After telling us that, books are endless, reading is exhausting, learning is exhausting, he's going to help us out in Ecclesiastes 12:13, and he's going to say to us the conclusion when all has been heard. Solomon says if you took all of those 130 million books and those 2 billion websites and 500 new hours, if you took all of that together and you just said, okay, what's it really all about, Solomon? In one sentence, tell me what it's about. He would say this, fear God and keep His commandments, because this applies to every person. This is what, at the end of the day, it's all about. Fear God and keep His commandments. I want to focus on that second phrase there. Do you know how many commandments were in the Old Testament? Because Solomon was under the Old Testament. You know how many commandments were in the Old Testament? 613. That's all of them, by the way. If you want to read them, you can come up here when I'm done and pull that back up and read every single one. That's all of them. 613 commandments. Solomon says what it's all about is doing that. He said, wait a minute, that's 613. That's a lot of commandments. Well, the Proverbs had introduced in the Old Testament, or the prophets rather, the prophets had introduced the idea that some commandments were more important than others. So you've got 613, but there are some of them that are a bigger deal than others. To obey is better than sacrifice. I desire compassion and not sacrifice. He's told you, O man, what is good and what does the Lord require of you but to walk humbly and love justice and do kindness and all of that. So the prophets had already told us that there are some things more important than others. And then later Jews came along and they said, well, what about when commands conflict? What about when you have commands that go against one another? What if you're supposed to obey your parents, but your parents tell you to violate the Sabbath? Then what do? What about when commands conflict? What about when you're supposed to remain ritually clean, but somebody dies and they need burying? Well, then what do? And they had these questions. Well, what if you make a vow that you learn is unlawful, and the Bible says, keep your vows, do you keep it or break it? And they were always unsure what to do about those things. And then the Jews had conversations about what laws were the most important. Does it surprise you that some Jews suggested that the Sabbath was the most important law? Some Jews said the Sabbath is the most important command. Some Jews said, and I tend to agree with this group, that honoring your parents is the most important command. This is the most important thing that a person can do. Others said it was love your neighbor. And so there are all these conversations, and we wonder about what is it exactly that we're supposed to be doing? In other words, why am I here? Why do I exist? Why did God put me and you and us as humans on this planet? I believe that Jesus answers that question in Matthew 22. So that's going to be our text for this morning, Matthew chapter 22, as we begin a series of lessons on life's big questions. And we're going to start with probably the biggest question of all: why are we here? Why do I exist? Why am I here? Well, if you ask that question to a lot of different people, you'd get a lot of different answers. The moral of this slide, by the way, is when you make last-minute changes, run it through again to make sure that it's working correctly. So I'm just going to tell you it's not. So I need to check that more closely from now on. At any rate, if you ask people, different people, what's the point of your life? If you ask an environmentalist would say it's protecting nature. That above all, above everything else, nothing else matters except protecting the environment. That's the most important thing. If you asked an agnostic would say, I don't have a clue. I don't know what the point of life is, and you can't know either. Nobody can know. We're at a loss. We'll never know what it is. If you asked a humanist would say that the point of existence is your own personal improvement and improving society around you. So there it is. If you asked an atheist, what is the point of life? An atheist would tell you, there is no point to life. An atheist would say, you're an accident. And an accident cannot have a purpose. There is no purpose in life. And if you ask a hedonist would say, it is maximum pleasure. Whatever you can do to enjoy yourself, that's the point of life. And all these people have all of these questions. Or all of these answers, rather. Well, what does Jesus say? Jesus answers the question in Matthew 22. Something doesn't look right there. Oh, wait a minute. There we go. I don't know about you, but I'll never be able to see him in a different way ever again. So just so we're all on the same page there. What did Jesus say about that? When a Pharisee came to Jesus and said, what is the great commandment? Now, why was the Pharisee asking? Was the Pharisee asking because it was an honest question, because he really wanted to know? He was trying to trap Jesus. But Jesus takes the opportunity to answer this very important question. And the answer is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. And Jesus said, bonus answer, love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments, he said, hang all the law and the prophets. In other words, everything that God, take all 613 commandments, all of them, put them in a pot, boil them down, two things are left. Love God and love your neighbor. That's all there is. And so when we ask the question, why am I here? Well, the answer is to love. Because both of those answers have that in common. The answer is, I am here to love. I am here to love God with all of my being, and I am here to love other people in the same way and to the same degree to which and in which I love myself. So I am here to love. The Bible supports this statement. 1 Corinthians 13:13. Now abide three things. What are they? Faith, hope, and love. But what? The greatest of these is love, even greater than faith, even greater than hope. Why? Because love is the only one of the three that is eternal. When we get to heaven, we won't need faith. Everything will be sight. When we get to heaven, we won't need hope. Everything will be realized. But when we get to heaven, there will still be love. And so love is the greatest. Love is the fulfillment. Paul said twice, the fulfillment of the law. And Peter said in 1 Peter 4, above all, keep the commandment of love. And so the answer is, I am here to love. But that's extremely vague. What is love? Because love can be all kinds of things. Love can be a score in tennis. Love can be a car. Herbie. The what? The love bug. Right? Love can be something you feel for fried pork chops, mashed potatoes, and gravy, or something you feel for your spouse. We won't discuss which of those is stronger and more permanent, but it can be either one. You can love your favorite college team. I'm a little iffy on mine right now. You can love getting up in the morning, or you can love not getting up in the morning. And so love is a very difficult thing to define. What is love? Scientists tell us today, because a lot of science, if not most of science, is purely materialistic. And what scientists increasingly believe today is that there's nothing outside the material world. And so, when you were in high school, and you looked across the room, and there was little Susie or little Stevie with their blonde hair and blue eyes, and their cute little dimple, and their sweet smile, and you looked across and you saw them, and you were just smitten with love. All that was, they say, is a chemical reaction. There are chemicals in your brain that bang into each other, and that's what you think is love. That's what science tells us today. Some people think love is just an emotion or a feeling, or that it's simply getting excited or having fervor. If I go to church and get excited, then I love God. If I go to church and don't get excited, then maybe I don't love God. And to a lot of people, it's simply that. Is love a natural attraction? Is it something that you just feel naturally? Well, of course, music has wrestled with this for a very long time. Is this love? The song asked. Because I want to know what love is. But how will I know? According to Whitney, what's love, Tina said, got to do with it anyway? Well, love is the answer. So what is love? Well, according to John Mayer, love is a verb. And that's exactly right. That's exactly where we get to. When we define and discuss what love is, what we find is that love is a verb. Love is never about what you feel. Love is never about what you say. It is about what you do. Loving God in the Bible, in the Old Testament, love of God is mentioned 6 times. In the Old Testament, love of God is mentioned 6 times. Every single time, without fail, it's connected to obedience. Never in the Old Testament does it talk about love and say, here's what you ought to feel. Every single time in the Old Testament, when it talks about love, it says, this is what you must do. Every single time. Without fail. We say, well, we're not under the Old Testament. We don't live back then when it was all about the external and nothing with the internal, which is ludicrous. We don't live under the Old Testament. I bet the New Testament doesn't talk that way, but in fact, it does. John, who was the apostle of love, said this, by this we know that we have come to know Him, if we keep His commandments. The one who says, I have come to know Him, and does not keep His commandments is a liar. But whoever keeps His word, in him the love of God has truly been perfected. By this we know that we are in Him. If you ask the Apostle John, how will I know if I love God? John would not say warm and fuzzy. John would not say goose flesh. John would not say, I don't know where that came from. But goosebumps is better. John would not say excitement. John wouldn't say any of that. If you ask John, how can I know that I love God? He would say, are you doing what God told you to do? This is the love of God, that we keep His commandments, John said. Well, somebody might say, well, wait a minute. That's John. John wasn't Jesus, and I would imagine that Jesus saw things a little differently than that. Well, let's see. First of all, in Luke chapter 6 and verse 46, Jesus makes the statement, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? But specifically about love, Jesus said this, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. He who keeps them is the one who loves me. And then in chapter 15, if you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love. So if you were to ask Jesus, what proves, Jesus, that I love you? If I love you, Jesus, What will the evidence be? What would he say? He would not talk about your feelings. He would not talk about your words. He would talk about your what? Your actions. What it is that you do. In the New Testament, we find again that love is defined by obedience. That should come as no surprise. That should come as no surprise. If someone in your life says, I love you, but they mistreat you, you will not believe that they love you. If your children claim to love you but disobey you, you will not believe their claim of love. If your spouse says they love you, but they mistreat you, you will not believe that. If a fellow believer comes to church and sings songs about how much they love you, and then they gossip about you, you're not going to believe that. Because love is demonstrated by what you do, not what you feel or say. So what is it that we're supposed to be doing in obedience to God? Well, we can define it by six things, six ways that we have to be obedient to God. Number one, you must be obedient to the gospel. You must obey, Paul said, from the heart, the form of teaching that God has given. If you are not a Christian, you must obey the commands that God has given you in the gospel, believing in Jesus, confessing Jesus, repenting of your sin, and baptism in water. You must obey Him when it comes to your personal spiritual growth. You must engage in the habits that cause you to grow. Bible study, personal prayer, church attendance, all of those things that cause you to grow. You must obey Him in personal holiness, doing the things every day that He commands you to do. You must obey Him by worshiping Him and being devoted to Him. You must worship Him, and you must worship Him as He has told you to. You have to obey Him in serving others. You must provide for the needs of other people and do the things that they need. And you must obey Him in kingdom influence. You must do everything you can to reach others for the kingdom and to bring them in if they are willing. This is what the Bible means. I wanted in this lesson not to leave it in abstraction. Love God. What does that mean? Here's what the Bible says. Loving God means to obey Him by becoming a Christian, growing in your faith, obeying Him daily, worshiping and being devoted to Him, serving other people, and trying to reach others and bring them into the kingdom as well. But Jesus said one more thing that we'll notice before we're done, and that is that we are here to love others as we love ourselves. What would that mean? Well, if love of God is always connected to the way you act, what do you think love of other people would be connected to? Did Jesus ever say anything that would define what it means to love others? Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12, Jesus put it this way: treat other people the same way that you want them to treat you. Notice that it's connected again to action, not to feelings and not to words. Well, again, I wanted to make that specific and practical, so I asked myself, for me personally, how do I want other people to treat me? If I'm supposed to treat Neil and Tristan and Ricky and Mary and Edwin, if I'm supposed to treat them like I want to be treated, how do I want to be treated? And what I realized after asking myself questions and exploring the issue, this is what I realized: that I want other people to do for me. Birthday presents. Lots of birthday presents. If you don't know what to get me, that's okay. Cash is always acceptable. It's the perfect gift. Other than that, what I want from other people is for them to respect me. I want people to respect my feelings. I want them to respect my boundaries. I want them to take no for an answer. I want them to listen when I say, I don't like that. I don't want to do that. That's not for me. Or whatever it might be. I want people to respect me. And I want people to see me and to appreciate me. I want people to notice that I'm there. I want people to notice that I exist. And I want people to notice when I do something that's good or helpful, I would like that to be appreciated. I'd like it to be noticed. I would like for people to listen to me. And I would like for people not only to hear the sound of my words, I want people to hear me. I would like for people, when I'm in a conversation with them, to look at me and listen to what I'm saying. I would like for them to be engaged, to ask questions, to clarify, to discuss, to let me know that they're listening, not simply thinking about the next thing that they're going to say. I would like to be listened to and heard. I would really like to be loved unconditionally and forgiven fully. I would really desire that people love me not for who I am as long as I'm what they want or think I ought to be. I would love for people to love me not for what I can do for them, but I would love for people to love me just because they do, just because they love me. And when I do something wrong, I would like to be forgiven entirely. Not mostly, not today and not tomorrow, but fully. I would love to be accepted as I am, but at the same time, challenged and encouraged to grow. I would love for people to accept me as a flawed human being while challenging me and helping me to get better. Not simply accepting me if I am what they think I ought to be. And finally, I would love for people, when I struggle, to patiently help me. I would love for people to come alongside me and say, what can I do? How can I help? And I'm going to be there with you patiently because I know you're not perfect and I know you won't always get it right, but I will be here as long as I need to be to help you to do the thing that you're trying to work on. That's what I would like. So that's my list. I don't know what your list would be. I would encourage you to make one. I would encourage you to ask yourself, what do I like? What do I not like? What do I appreciate, not appreciate in other people? Make a list. And when you have made your list of what you want, you will have made your list of what you need to do to others. Now we'll wrap all that up in just a second. Before we do, next Sunday morning, the second of our questions, how do I handle life's uncertainties? What do we do when things are uncertain or difficult? What do we do about that? We'll talk about that tonight. Lord willing, we'll be back here at the building at 6 p.m. for a Bible study on Leviticus 9 and 10. Leviticus 10 has a very well-known account, Nadab and Abihu. But there's something that happened before that and something that happened after that we don't often talk about. And so we're going to talk about all of that tonight, Leviticus 9 and 10, Lord willing, at 6 p.m. So, why are you here? Why are you, as a human being, on this planet? What is the purpose of your existence? To love God with all of your being and to love other people in the same way and to the same degree as yourself. Now, what is it exactly that you do with that? Well, that means that you obey God in the things that we talked about. It means that you treat other people the way you want them to treat you. So I want to ask you six questions. I want to give you six questions to think about to apply what we have talked about this morning. What does all of this mean? So here are six questions. What does all of this mean for you today? In a moment, we're going to dismiss this. We're going to hang around a little bit. Then we're going to go do our afternoon thing. Then we'll come back together tonight. Then we'll leave again and be with people. What does obeying God and treating other people like you want to be treated look like for you today? Just today, what does that mean? What does it mean as you go throughout your week? Tomorrow, you get back to your... We've had some days off, and we've overeaten, and we've overslept, and we've done all... Tomorrow, it's all over, right? We go back to normal. What does it look like to obey God and to treat other people like you want to be treated? What does that look like? What does it look like for you in 2025? What a great opportunity here at the end of the year to say, this past year, how have I not been obedient to God the way that I should have been? This past year, how have I not treated other people the way I want to be treated? And how can I change that in 2025? And then three more. What does it look like for you at home? What does obeying God look like for you at home? And what does it look like as you interact with the people at your house to treat them the way that you want to be treated? What does it look like at work or whatever that is for you, school or whatever that might be for you? What does that look like? And then finally, what does it look like when it comes to your relationship with the church? To be obedient to God, to treat other people the way that you want to be treated. How can you apply those things to each part of your life today, this week, and in the coming year? Well, take out your songbook and turn to the invitation song. We're going to sing that in just a moment. I am resolved, Jeffrey, is that right? So that's a great thought, and it's what everything begins with. As long as you haven't seriously resolved to be obedient to God and to treat other people the way that you want to be treated, you will continue not to. As long as you'd like to do it, you're thinking about doing it, you're sort of trying to do it a little better, it doesn't work. What it begins with is a resolution. And this is an opportunity for you to make a resolution. This is the day where I begin to be obedient in the things that God wants from me. This is the day that I resolve to start treating other people, even the difficult ones, even the knuckleheads, even people who deserve differently. This is where it changes. So I would encourage you as we sing the song, whatever resolution you need to make, make it. And if it's a resolution that involves you coming to the front or getting with us later so that we can help you in some way, we're ready to do that. So think about those things. As we sing this song, you're welcome to meet with us probably after church, or you can come forward as we stand and sing.